ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's been 50 years since the biggest scandal in Australian political history.
It really is one of the most extraordinary times ever seen in the national capital.
It's a gripping story about big egos and big mistakes. It's a love story, it's a spy thriller, and there are still secrets left to uncover.
There is a document which is still under lock and key. They will not release it.
You can hear the ABC's award-winning podcast on the whole saga right now. Search for The 11th on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is David Rutledge. Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. I've been thinking this week about the robo-debt scandal that came to light a couple of years back, but had a recent flurry of attention in the media as the federal government agreed to pay $475 million in compensation to the victims of robo-debt. And for our international listeners, just to quickly catch you up, robo-debt was a scheme rolled out by the previous federal government, and it was designed to make sure that nobody was cheating on the welfare system. The scheme was automated, it was hopelessly inept, it was also illegal, and it resulted in poor and vulnerable people being hounded for debts that they didn't owe, forcing them into even more dire financial circumstances than they were already in, and according to the subsequent Royal Commission into the scheme, driving at least three people to suicide. Probably many more. But the reason our elected representatives were able to think that they could get away with this cruel and inept scheme in the first place had to do with an assumption that lies coiled within the Australian national consciousness. And that's the assumption that if you're poor, then at some level, that's the result of bad choices or bad behaviour on your part. And that if you don't have a job, for example, then all you really need to do is go out and find one. A corollary of this assumption is that if you're on unemployment benefits, then your life should be as miserable as possible, because the more comfort you enjoy as a welfare recipient, the less incentive you have to get off the couch. This assumption comes through loud and clear in a recent poll in the UK, where people were asked what they thought the recipients of unemployment benefits should be able to afford. And the results were amazingly grim. Only about 50% of respondents said that the unemployed should be able to afford a television or home internet. Around 35% said that people on benefits should be able to afford an active hobby like going to the gym. And only around 25% believed that people on benefits should be able to afford to socialise at a pub or restaurant or to take a vacation within the UK. And if you think that's a uniquely British species of meanness, then consider that the job seeker allowance for a single person in Australia is well below the poverty line, and nobody's out marching in the street about that, or about the notion that the system of mutual obligation, whereby the unemployed are required to undertake certain tasks and activities while receiving their welfare payments, is, according to my guest this week, an onerous, humiliating, and even punitive system. Jeanette Kennett is a philosopher specialising in moral psychology and applied ethics at Macquarie University in Sydney, and we're talking this week about poverty and punishment. Jeanette, welcome to the program. I want to begin with a very good point that you make, that presenting poverty as an individual problem caused by individual moral failings, individual bad luck, that actually serves a particular political purpose. It sort of lets politicians off the hook in some sense. Can you explain that?
Yes. Well, if poverty is an individual moral failing, if it's a failing of the individual, if it's their fault that they're in poverty, then we can preserve this view of our society as a just and fair one, and that there's no structural change needed. So insofar as we're going to help people climb out of poverty, we have to target them and their sort of individual capacities and qualities. We don't have to make any sort of major changes to society. So it actually, I think, suits politicians, and I think in our country on both the major parties, to kind of rely a bit on a bunch of myths about poverty. So there was a church, a combined churches task force in England, which sort of collated a list of poverty myths, and they included, and they're very widespread, these will be so familiar, that people who are reliant on welfare are lazy and they don't want to work, they could get a job if they wanted, they don't manage their money properly, you know, it's sort of the avocado toast issue writ large, they're on the fiddle, that is, they're actively defrauding the system, and that they're having some kind of easy life on benefits. So all of these myths serve to generate a bit of resentment in taxpayers who are working, because they think, wow, I'm supporting somebody else to live in idleness. And if these people got off their tails and worked hard like I do, they wouldn't be living in poverty. So it's useful politically to have this sort of feeling of resentment and suspicion towards people who are reliant on income support, because it means that you can keep the payments low without too much flack, and you've got somebody easy to blame for things. You know, I'm not saying that politicians explicitly take this view, although I think some of them definitely do, but it's there and it's in our culture. And, you know, you see it in tabloid headlines, you know, scandals about welfare fraud, which is actually extremely low in Australia. I think verified welfare fraud is less than 1%. So really what we're doing is demonising a whole group of people supposedly to capture a very, very small proportion of them.
Yeah, and I guess that what that means for policymakers, even if, as you say, they're not necessarily evil or punitive-minded people themselves, it is easier, isn't it, if you're in charge of rolling out social welfare, to make it about the management and control of individuals rather than to do something about the social and structural causes of poverty.
Yes, and I also think politicians, naturally enough, are susceptible to social pressure and media pressure, and making sure that taxpayer dollars are spent wisely and not wasted. But it's interesting that there's this much scrutiny on the taxpayer dollars that are going out to the poorest part of society, and not nearly so much scrutiny on the dollars that are going out to the better off part of society. So I think there's this idea that there's this big group of people who are just not contributors, and we're entitled to manage and control them in very, very minute ways, even though it's very expensive to do so. We spend a lot of money doing that, and it's not clear that we're getting good results for our taxpayer dollar. If that was really what you were interested in, you probably wouldn't do it this way. So I think politicians too swallow the myths. I mean, genuinely believe that you've got to keep an eye on these people, because politicians don't come from those backgrounds by and large.
Yeah, yeah. I'd like to get into some of the philosophical or ethical justifications for what we're critiquing at the moment, because those justifications do exist. But first of all, let's have a look at this idea of mutual obligation, which is the condition imposed on recipients of income support in Australia. And you've written about how, in practice, the mutual obligation requirements can be extremely onerous, often humiliating for people who are receiving income support. They can even be financially damaging to those people. How does that all work?
Well, there are so many stories. And here I do want to acknowledge a whole bunch of anti-poverty campaigners and people living in poverty, the Anti-Poverty Centre, the Unemployed Workers Union, and individuals who I have learned quite a lot from, mainly from following them on Twitter. I think it's really important to listen to the voices of the people who live in this system, and also the many, many submissions that have been made to the Senate inquiries and to the Robodebt Royal Commission. So people describe a system that's quite arbitrary, that it's very easy to fall foul of and very hard to put things right. They describe a system where their time is not valued or respected. So, you know, it's fine if you have to sit on a phone to Centrelink all day, because it's assumed that you've got nothing better to do with your time. So the myths, the poverty myths, feed into the attitude and the way the system is structured. Unemployed people don't have, or, you know, people on income support don't have anything better to do with their time than to sit on the phone, so we can make them do that. We can make them run around. We can make them submit documents three or four times. We can require them to come to appointments, even if, you know, there are many, many accounts of people who've been given an appointment by their job agency, and they explain that they'll be working at that time, because lots of people who are on job seeker do in fact have jobs. They're just not getting enough hours or enough money from them. So they will explain that they'll be working at that time. And very often they're told, no, you've got to come in anyway. Or they're given a phone appointment at a time that they can't take it for a good reason, and they let the agency know in advance, and then they get a notice to say that they've been breached and their payment is suspended. Now, having your meagre income entirely in the gift of a person across the other side of the desk is really undermining, and the kinds of requirements that people are put under, you know, to write their CV a particular way, to go to, you know, sometimes highly qualified people are required to go to courses that are actually run by these agencies that the government pays for, and told that, you know, they should brush their teeth and hair and wear clean clothes to an interview. You know, they're treated as children who don't know any better, who have to be told everything. Now, obviously, agencies vary and individual employees in agencies vary in how receptive they are and responsive they are to the person in front of them and how much actual genuine respect they show for that person. But the point is that it shouldn't, the way you're treated shouldn't be in the gift of a person, a single other person in that way. So people just feel very insecure. They don't know when they're going to lose their income. And if they do, then they can't buy food. They might not be able to pay their rent. They might lose their housing. I mean, the costs are very, very high for quite minor infringements. And although the suspensions are often reversed over the next few days, you can imagine the kind of stress that this imposes on people. You know, and I think that in general, people feel that they're not listened to and that their perspective just does not matter within the system.
People caught up in this system will often describe it as punitive. And I wonder if you think it is fair or accurate to say that the sanctions imposed on welfare recipients under mutual obligation are in fact punitive and in fact designed to be punitive.
Yes. Well, that was part of what got me interested. I mean, I've become interested in working on poverty over the last couple of years. But part of it was that seeing this system described as punitive and having worked a little bit on punishment and what is punishment and the justifications for punishment, I thought, well, philosophy should have something to say about this. So what is punishment? Well, it's the imposition of treatment which is intentionally unwelcome, burdensome, and harsh in response to actions for which the target of the punishment is thought to be blameworthy. So is this an accurate description of what goes on here? Furthermore, punishment expresses attitudes of resentment, indignation, and judgments of disapproval of the person. So it's essentially related, punishment, in our system to moral blame. Okay. Now, I think that all of these aspects of punishment are features of our current system, because the sanctions imposed on welfare recipients for various supposed infractions, you know, failing to report on time or, you know, not answering the phone when Centrelink calls, and they do that from unlisted numbers, so you're not sure it's them. And then when you pick up the phone, they'll say, oh, we need you to give your ID, give your name and date of birth. And then if you say, well, I'm not going to do that because I don't know who you are, is this Centrelink? Sometimes they say, we can't tell you. And then if you don't continue the conversation, you're in breach. So it's really, there is an arbitrariness that certainly is not typical of a well-run justice system. So in that respect, you know, maybe it doesn't even rise to a system of punishment, but it is definitely punitive, because it's unwelcome, it's burdensome, it's harsh, and it's done in response to actions for which you're considered blameworthy. And it does express, I think, moral disapproval of you.
Well, in the philosophical literature, I mean, we have different kinds of punishment, don't we? There's reformist punishment, which is meant to bring the offender to an awareness of their own wrongdoing, maybe be a better person. There's utilitarian punishment. That's about protecting the community, looking ahead and seeing, well, this person might be a danger to someone. We need to head that off. And then there's retributive punishment, which is about, you know, you did a bad thing and now you have to suffer. So if we say that the welfare system is punitive, which of those three kinds of punishment are being rolled out here?
I think that to the extent that the architects of the system would acknowledge that it's punitive, they would see it as utilitarian and reforming, you know, bring the person to a sense of what they owe back to the community. But I think, in fact, it's retributive. I think it's desert-based. I think people are seen as deserving of punishment. And I think it's retributive punishment. One of the justifications for retributive punishment is that it restores the balance of rights between victim and offender. Now, in these cases where the victim is supposed to be all of us honest taxpayers, the punishment is supposed to restore that balance and express our moral disapproval and condemnation. And it does succeed to the extent to which people on welfare who are subject to sanctions often feel a deep sense of shame and a loss of self-worth. But I think that what we have to focus on here is that punishment requires justification, and especially when it's punishment carried out by the state because of the vast power imbalance between the state and the individual. The state has pretty much all of the power and the individual has very little. So retributive punishment, the justifications for retributive punishment have to be that it's deserved, obviously, otherwise there can't be any question of punishment. But even supposing some punishment is deserved, which I, you know, would contest in these cases, it has to be fair and it has to be proportionate and it has to be a fair process. If we think about our courts, and obviously no system is perfect and systems get things wrong, there are very clear processes. A person has an advocate and the punishment has to be proportionate to the offence. You can't give disproportionate punishments. And in this case, the offence of missing an appointment, for that offence to be faced with a punishment that might mean you and your children go hungry or lose your shelter, that does not seem proportionate, even if you thought it was deserved, and I'm not so sure about that one.
On Radio National and the ABC Listen app, this is David Rutledge and you are right here with me in the Philosopher's Zone. My guest this week is Jeanette Kennett from Macquarie University, and we're talking about poverty and punishment. Let's have a look at some of the justifications in principle that might be put forward for the idea of mutual obligation. One is that we live in a society. We all have to contribute to the common good. We have to contribute our labour to keeping the economic wheels turning. And that's just how it is. You know. And if you offer people unconditional welfare, that provides too much of an incentive for people simply to opt out and not work. And so sanctions under that justification are a legitimate means of ensuring that people simply make their contributions and ensuring that public funds are not misused. How does that justification stack up, do you think?
Okay, well, there are some empirical questions here, obviously, and we would need to have good comparisons between outcomes where mutual obligations are imposed and outcomes where they're not imposed. There have been some small studies, admittedly done in the Netherlands, where they were able to, in one of the regions of the Netherlands, to separate and continue one group on mutual obligations as usual, conditional welfare, and the other group they gave conditional welfare to. And then they checked for outcomes, and the employment outcomes were no different. So we were, if we're concerned about public funds, that indicates that we're spending a lot of money for no benefit, except to make people's lives miserable. But that's, of course, not the only measure. I mean, you know, outcomes as who gets into employment is one measure, but there are other measures. And when they dug down into the data, they discovered that among the most disadvantaged groups, the ones who, you know, most likely to need welfare, there was a rise in sort of trust in society. So there were some other sorts of positive measures. And I think that if we're going to do research comparing conditional to unconditional welfare, we need to consider a range of outcomes. So not just who gets off welfare over a period of time, but other sorts of outcomes in terms of trust in society, capacity to contribute in across a range of measures, social participation, mental health. These things also, I think, need to be measured. So that's the empirical question. But if we're looking at the sort of moral principles that you're invoking here, which is the principle of, I guess, reciprocity and contribution to the common good, I think that those are sort of important principles that govern our relationships with other people and within society. However, I just want to say that reciprocity can't just be seen in a snapshot of a particular time. What did I give you today and what did you give me back today? Reciprocal relations are cross-temporal relations. And I might be more capable of contributing now and less capable later. Our capacities can go up and down. So I don't think it's a really good idea to take a snapshot of any sort of interaction, a one-time snapshot, and say, well, that person isn't contributing because they might not be contributing right now. And also, the concept of reciprocity doesn't mean same for same. I recently had a friend who is on the age pension visit me to stay with me, and we went out one day for a walk and we ended up in a restaurant. We were only going to have a coffee, but we had lunch and I paid for the lunch. And she looked at me and she said, you know, this is why I don't do this. She said, because I can't reciprocate. And, you know, I find that that is a troubling concept of reciprocation to impose on people, that it has to be like for like. There are many ways of reciprocating and many different kinds of contributions that people can make. And we have to recognise the variety of ways in which people contribute to their society. We should all recognise by now that women's work goes unrecognised, has gone unrecognised for centuries. Well, you know, so does the work of lots of people who are not in receipt of an income from a job or not in receipt from a high income from a job. You know, they might have caring responsibilities. They might be contributing to their community in a lot of different ways. When I look at the anti-poverty activists that I follow on Twitter, they are constantly providing support for other people in their interactions with Centrelink and in giving general advice to them and just giving moral support to them. I think there's reciprocation there. I think there's contribution to the community there. But our system isn't set up to recognise all those various contributions. And finally, I want to say that reciprocity, genuine reciprocity, fundamentally rests on mutual respect, recognition, and goodwill. It's not mutual if one party has all the power and the other party has none of the power, and if there's no consent to the way that the relationship interactions are proceeding. If all of that's lacking, then I think that it's kind of an abusive relationship. And so I think that if we're going to set up a system of mutual obligations, it has to be co-designed. We have to get both sides involved in designing what that system would look like.
Yeah, and on this question of reciprocity, I mean, this is something that you've pointed out in your work, that the elephant in the room when these discussions around welfare and obligations take place is that A measure of unemployment is baked into the economy. We supposedly have to have unemployment because the fewer unemployed people you have, the higher the cost of labour becomes, which means that employers start to feel the pinch and we get higher inflation. And, you know, I always feel that point doesn't get the attention it deserves, that as a class, unemployed people are making an important contribution to the economy simply by virtue of being unemployed.
Yes. And so then I think that we need to consider very seriously the morality of keeping people on very, very low payments where they cannot afford the necessities of life. And our payments, as has been acknowledged by many inquiries, are so low that they don't allow people to afford the basic necessities of life. If we rely on having a pool of unemployed people, then we need to give people an income adequate to live on. Because when we do in fact all benefit. When the levels of payments were raised during the pandemic, there was a lot of talk about, oh, suicide rates are going to rise because people are locked down and everything. In fact, they fell. And I think they fell because poverty fell. Because a lot of people felt for the first time that they were actually in the same boat as everyone else, you know, and people need to feel a part of their society.
But what about this argument, though, that while some people fall into unemployment or other kinds of hardship through sheer bad luck, through no fault of their own, that there are other people who fall into hardship through bad choices, voluntary behaviour, and that society, I wouldn't say has no obligation, but has a limited obligation to compensate those people. And if an income is provided for them, then it's perfectly fair and reasonable that strict conditions should be imposed.
Well, that's the old issue of deserving versus undeserving poor. And I find that a worrying distinction. Who's going to make it for a start? Who's going to judge? I mean, I'm not saying that there aren't some people who make persistently bad decisions. There are, plainly. And some people fall into poverty as a result of those persistently bad decisions. And maybe they don't have any excuse. Although usually I think if you dig, you'll find some trauma, mental health issues, there'll be other things that might explain their ending up in poverty. But once again, one, should we set up our system to weed out those people by treating everybody as if they might be those people? There's an old saying that hard cases make bad law, and especially when we're looking at social welfare structures, we shouldn't be building them on the basis of suspicion and lack of trust of our fellows. We have laws to deal with people who commit crimes and defraud systems and things like that. I actually think a system based on giving people agency, giving them back control of their lives, works better. And, you know, we have other ways, hopefully, of assisting people who are making persistently bad decisions to start making better ones. But we don't do it by treating everybody as if they're a criminal.
What I find interesting is that you connect this idea of deserving poor versus undeserving poor with the notion of self-control and something that poor people are often accused of lacking. You know, like, oh, I see you're smoking cigarettes. Those are very expensive. If you stopped smoking, you'd have more money for food. And you make the point that poverty actually removes important social resources that support the exercise of self-control. How is that the case?
Okay, so let's make a distinction between what I'd call diachronic self-control or even preemptive self-control, if you like, which is sort of control over how your life is going to go, control over your future and your future actions. Now, we can think of self-control like this. Often in psychology, it's put forward as the competition between smaller, sooner rewards, something nice I can have right now, or larger, later rewards, more important rewards like your career and next year's holiday and stuff like that. Okay. And the thought is that people who are lacking in self-control go for those smaller, sooner rewards and miss out on the better, larger, later rewards. Okay. So self-control over time is supposed to be directed at making sure that you plan your life such that you get those larger, later rewards and synchronic self-control or self-control in the moment is when there's a temptation here right now. You know, so there's anticipated temptations and planning for your goals on the one hand, and then there's dealing with actual things in the moment. Now, how does poverty undermine the long-term forms of self-control? Well, a lot of those forms of self-control take certain sorts of resources and a kind of a confidence and security that things will keep ticking along pretty much okay. So what I want to say is that you need confidence. You need to believe that this is a future that is open to you, that you could achieve by what you do. And you need to feel like that's me, you know, that future person who's having the holiday or the career or the family or buying that house. That's me. So it's not enough just to think that would be a good thing and I would like to have it. You've got to think these are steps to getting it that are available to me and I can see myself in that position. It's not just a good thing for someone to have. It's something that I could do. And I think if you're poor, it's really hard to meet both of those conditions. I mean, suppose you're on a low income and you think you'd like to give your kids a holiday, you know, an annual holiday. And so you think, okay, well, I'm pretty poor, but I could put away this much each week and we could buy a tent and we could have a week at a camping ground, you know, modest. But then the car blows up and all your savings have to go on fixing the car or you can't go to work. And then on top of that, the fridge breaks down and so you're in debt. You know, you don't have any buffer zone. And so you just give up and you might feel really depressed and like a failure because you couldn't give your kids a holiday. And then there are people on welfare for whom that's just not even in the spectrum. So you need some level of financial security in order to be able to do a lot of things. Also, there are things that cost more if you're poor. I mean, I'll give you an example. I pay my granddaughter's phone. Now, every 6 months, I put another 6 months on. That costs $150. But if I didn't have $150, then I have to pay $30 every 4 weeks. Now, that adds up to quite a bit more over 6 months. So that 6 months for a poor person is more expensive than it is for a better off person. And this goes over and over and over again, that you can't do a lot of long-term things because they'll cost money that you don't have in the here and now to plan for. And also, so many of those goods just seem out of reach. Now, if those goods seem out of reach, because very often they actually are out of reach, then you have to focus on the here and now. You have to focus on getting through your day. And getting through your day sometimes means taking those smaller, sooner rewards because that's what will get you through a difficult day. Now, we do that too. Well-off people do that too. You know, we have our lattes. We have our glass of wine when we get home. All of those things, they're not looked down on. But if a poor person has a donut instead of an apple, if they smoke a cigarette to get through a difficult shift at work because it will just get them through, they will be judged as lacking in self-control when actually they're engaging in some self-management. And I think that that goes unrecognised too.
Well, with all this in mind, Jeanette, I just have one final question, and that's that the thing that always depresses me, I suppose, about certain politicians, certain sectors of the media demonising welfare recipients is that it's really popular. You know, it's like going after asylum seekers. People respond very positively to that. It's a proven vote winner. And I'm not sure if it's the politicians in the media who are creating and feeding that prejudice or if the prejudice is already there in our national consciousness and they're just picking up on it. But in the wake of robo-debt, and where, you know, where the punitive nature of that welfare system and the harm that it can do has been so directly exposed, how much hope do you see for change in public attitudes towards people on welfare, people living in poverty?
I wish I could be more optimistic, but the attitudes that I see don't encourage me to think that. And I think that part of the problem is because the people who are living under that system don't get a regular voice. They're not the people invited onto the drum, for example. I mean, the drum gets a reasonable range of people, but the actual people who are, you know, living in the system, they don't get a voice. I don't think that our media does a great job of listening to a wide range of people. They've got their go-to people. It's easier. And after all, I think the media needs to take a good look at its own composition. Our media now, I think, is not nearly as working class as it used to be, not nearly as in touch with the worst off people in society as it used to be. I'm not saying that there was necessarily a super golden age for this, and I think, you know, there's always been populist media, but I really think there is a lot of ignorance in the media. I think there is, here as in other areas of public life, a real failure to listen to the people. I mean, I shouldn't be the one speaking out about this. I mean, I do have relatives, I do have people close to me who live in poverty and who I help as best I can. But it really should be those people who are speaking about this, not me. And what does give me some optimism is that I think that there is a generation of anti-poverty activists coming up, and I don't think they're going to let up. I think that this will have to be reckoned with in a better way than we've been doing up until now.
Jeanette Kennett, she's an honorary professor in the Department of Philosophy at Sydney's Macquarie University. And if you'd like to check out her website and some selected publications, which I strongly recommend that you do, she's doing some really interesting work, then we've got the info on our website, which is the Philosopher's Zone. And of course, you can stream or download this and all of our past programs via the ABC Listen app. I'm David Rutledge. Thanks for your company, and I hope you can join me next time. Bye for now.